Hello, can you hear me all right? Okay, good. Tony Hoagland was one of the most important influential poets and poetry teachers in the United States from the 1990s up until his death last year. And without a doubt, his poems will continue to be read and taught and talked about. While there can be some arbitrariness about which U.S. poets get British publishers and which ones don't, it seems to me absolutely essential that Hoagland found an audience here through Blood Axe, his UK publisher, as well as his visits to this festival in particular and his readings elsewhere in the UK. Tony Hoagland was the author of 7 collections of poetry and 3 books of prose about poetry, most recently The Art of Voice, which has just been released and which is dedicated to all students of poetry, especially his students. Hoagland himself had a greatly appealing poetic voice. As American poet Kevin Prufer says of him, Tony Hoagland was one of our great masters of the nuances, complexities, and vagaries of poetic voice. As for the content and manner of his poems, I thought of Hoagland yesterday when Jeremy Noel Todd listed the different genres that could be contained in prose poems: lyric poetry, aphorism, anecdote, fairy tale, allegory, joke, etc. While Hoagland himself was not a prose poet particularly, his poems seemed to hold so many genres with absolute grace. And for that reason, he's an important poet for me. And he's also important to me because his poems are in touch with unprepossessing aspects of our psyche. His lyric personas often weren't pretty or pleasing, but were interested in honesty and clear-eyed self-awareness. I didn't know Tony Hoagland myself, so I'm going to hand things over to 4 individuals who did know him to varying degrees. Joining us today are Joshua Weiner, an American poet and academic, who knew Tony Hoagland a bit through the Fine Arts Work Center in Provincetown, a residency program for emerging poets, where Josh is chair of the writing committee. Then we'll have Peter Sansom, a poet, editor, and popular teacher of poetry who was a great fan of Hoagland's work and knew him a little. Martin Shaw, author, teacher, storyteller, and director of the West Country School of Myth. Martin Shaw translated Gaelic poems and folklore with Tony Hoagland. And finally, we have Kathleen Lee here with us today, who was Tony's widow. Josh, when you're ready, could you come up? Thank you.
Well, it's an honor to be on this panel. I've been a reader of Tony Hoagland since his first book, Sweet Ruin, was published in 1992, chosen by Donald Justice for the Brittingham Prize. But I didn't really know about him at that time, and I wasn't very familiar with his poems prior to that, even though he'd been publishing in journals and magazines and even some chapbooks or what are called here pamphlets. He was only 10 years older than me, but I just simply missed him, as one does. But when that book came out, it's difficult to describe the effect it had, not just on me, but on a lot of young poets, especially young men. This probably had something to do with the psychic struggle with the father that's part of that book's heavy charge, but also the stories he told about masculinity, the way he made himself vulnerable in his poems, especially about sex, and the way he poked at male posturing. Tony never cherished his vulnerability, but rather took to it with a flimsy knife of abject self-derogation coupled with self-forgiveness. It was as if Robert Lowell, with his ironic eye and feeling for telling narrative detail, and Allen Ginsberg, with his fearless and unembarrassed compassion, had gotten together to invent a poet for the millennial turn. Hoagland's poems were painfully, poignantly funny without any rhetorical clowning around. And I mean, they still are. His poems exist in the present tense, of course, but I'm thinking historically of my own reading of them at the time and the effect they had on me. I was startled then by their self-assurance with a crystal-clear dramatic voice, each one unfolding with a shapeliness kept buoyant by a feeling of spontaneity at every point. The poems had an amazing way of opening up and folding back on themselves. In a final note in his last book, published last year, Tony writes that a poem is a dramatic fiction pitched in the voice of a particular speaker, part playfulness, part affectation, part dead seriousness. The solidity and definition of that vocal particularity was present from the beginning. Each bold opening in Sweet Ruin expanded with surprising turns of thinking and feeling, discovered in the moment, and always in touch with the poem's originary impulse, its emotional reason for being, even as it improvised to the outer limit of what plausibly could be said. That was one of the things his poems suggested poems might actually be for, to create a space in which one could bypass polite and deadening decorum and speak an emotional truth, a truth that not only others but parts of oneself objected to because so uncomfortable, so threatening to the stabilizing fictions we tell ourselves about ourselves and each other. They were personal poems, and they were also political, but not in an obvious way. It was as if he was discovering in the process of composition what a political feeling, a political emotion as opposed to a political idea really felt like, what it really meant, what its implications were for a self that was trying desperately to define itself in the soulful dialectic of losing itself. The poems were so smart, intelligent, yet earnest, self-reflexive, yet searching, both cool and fearlessly revealing, utterly devoid of any pretension, any intellectualism, or overheated presumptions. They told their stories with the poise and energy of a Sonny Rollins in touch with his inner Lester Young. The book was a total knockout, and when it came out, my poet's friends and I, we read it and we just thought, fuck, you know, new bar set, what are we going to do? But actually, Tony wasn't that young himself. He was about to hit 40. He had been in the woodshed all this time leading up and into the writing of those poems in Sweet Ruin, blowing notes, playing scales, and refining his chops, discovering his art, and specifically, not just how a poem is made, but how he, Tony Hoagland, was born to make poems. He was discovering not just his voice, but his practice. Reading back through Sweet Ruin this fall, 27 years after it first exploded and ruined our lives for a while, I'm amazed again, but this time not by the auspiciousness of the debut, but rather the completeness of it. In his first full-length book, Tony Hoagland stepped onto the stage fully formed. Not as a person, I don't know anything about that, but rather as a poetic personality, wry, droll, alert, tense, confident, ready to go to the hard place, ask the hard questions, and live with the even harder answers. And this was what Sweet Ruin was telling us in 1992, with all the wit, high-spirited splendor, and formal accomplishment that would define every instance of what we now know to be his body of work, stunning today in a new way for its internal coherence from beginning to end, and its total allegiance to poetry as an art of the meaningful reach. I did come to know Tony personally. We had both been fellows at the Fine Arts Work Center in Provincetown, an artist residency on the tip of Cape Cod. He sometime before me, but we worked together on the jury that chose the fellowships for the subsequent years and spent time together in Provincetown when we saw each other. Tony was tough, incisive, and his judgments kind of incontestable. He really knew what he was talking about, and it was very annoying. Always instructive, though. And as anyone who's read his brilliant essays knows, his taste was very broad, his sympathies Catholic, with that keen eye. And he kept the pressure on. He inspired you, meaning me, to work at my highest level, however limited that might have been. If you were in the room with them, Tony had a way of arching his eyebrow at you to tell you that you were being stupid. He could tilt his head 2 degrees and totally devastate you. He had an ironic smile that communicated both his affection for you and the sense that you were a funny kind of plant in social reality. I was never in his presence very long without laughing, often at myself. But he also didn't take himself too seriously, or so seriously to lose sight of what I think of as the framework. And for Tony, it was always cosmic in scale, and thereby humbling to the small self that was always important enough because it was the only self that you had to start with, no matter how far you could imaginatively extend it. So I wanted to read a couple of poems. The first, because especially it's from that first book that made such an impact on me, but also because it's not a book that's available here in the UK. The title poem, Sweet Ruin, which maybe is available in the Blood Axe Selected. Sweet Ruin. Maybe that is what he was after, my father, when he arranged 10 years ago to be discovered in a mobile home with a woman named Roxanne, an attractive, recently divorced masseuse. He sat there, he said later, in the middle of a red imitation leather sofa with his shoes off and a whiskey in his hand, filling up with a joyful kind of dread, like a swamp filling up at night. While my mother hammered on the trailer door with a muddy, pried-up stone, then smashed the headlights of his car, drove home, and locked herself inside. He paid the piper, was how he put it, because he wanted to live. And at the time, knew no other way than to behave like some blind and willful beast, to make a huge mistake, like a big leap into space, as if following a music that required dissonance and a plunge into the dark. That is what he tried to tell me the afternoon we talked, as he reclined in his black chair, divorced from the people in his story by 10 years and a heavy cloud of smoke. Trying to explain how a man could come to a place where he has nothing else to gain unless he loses everything. So he louses up his work, his love, his own heart. He hails disaster like a cab. And years later, when the storm has descended and rubbed his face in the mud of himself, he stands again and looks around, strangely thankful just to be alive, oddly jubilant, as if he had been granted the answer to his riddle, or as if the question had been taken back. Perhaps a wind is freshening the grass, and he can see now, as for the first time, the softness of the air between the blades, the pleasure built into a single bending leaf. Maybe then he calls it, in a low voice, and only to himself, sweet ruin. And maybe only because I am his son, I can hear just what he means. How even at this moment, even when the world seems so perfectly arranged, I feel a force prepared to take it back, like a smudge on the horizon, like a black spot on the heart. How one day soon, I may take this nervous paradise, bone and muscle of this extraordinary life, and with one deliberate gesture, like a man stepping on a stick, break it into halves. But less gracefully than that. I think there must be something wrong with me, or wrong with strength, that I would break my happiness apart simply for the pleasure of the sound. The sound the pieces make. What is wrong with peace? I couldn't say, but Sweet ruin, I can hear you. There is always the desire, always the cloud, suddenly present and willing to oblige. Fathers don't typically fare well in American poems, not since we first started coming across them in the landscape about 50 years into the last century. But in Sweet Ruin, the son draws close to the father by finding in himself that thing that belongs to a hot darkness in all of us. And that poem opens in the end with, I find, just beautiful nuance and complexity around the figure of that cloud, such an unusual emblem of personal destructive agency in the guise of fate. I wanted to end with a poem that's towards the end of his last book, Priest Turned Therapist Treats Fear of God, that was published last year. And I know when I finish the poem, there'll be nothing left for me to say. I think you'll hear how the older poet's intelligence has moved through great pain into a new vision and maybe something like a new vocabulary, all the more powerful for the homely perfection of the poem's final poignant image. In typical Hoagland fashion, gallows humor kicks off the poem with the title, I Have Good News. I have good news. When you are sick for the last time in your life, walking around shaky, frail with your final illness, feeling the space between yourself and other people grow wider and wider, like the gap between a rowboat and its dock, you will begin to see the plants and flowers of your youth. And they will look as new to you as they did back then. Little lavender bouquets arranged in solar systems, delicate beyond your comprehension. The dark gold buttons with the purple manes, the swan white throat splashed with radish colored flecks, the thread-like stalks that end in asterisks. They are where you left them, by the bus stop bench, along the chain link fence, behind the widow's house. And you shall squat down on your heels and gaze at them, just as you did before. Because this restitution of your heart is coming. You need not fear the indignities of death and growing old. The synagogue of Weedhead will be your evidence that every moment is not trampled by the march of all the rest. It doesn't matter if you end up isolated and alone, pulling the trigger of the morphine feed repeatedly. It doesn't matter if you die, whimpering into the railing of the hospital bed, refusing to see visitors, smelling your own body in the dawn. The dark ending does not cancel out the brightness of the middle. Your day of greatest joy cannot be dimmed by any shame. The traffic goes by on Shepherd Avenue. The honeysuckle vine braids in and out and in the spokes of the abandoned bicycle.
It's a privilege to be reading. I'm going to read two poems, I was in the audience a couple of times when Tony Hoagland read here, and I remember at least on one of the occasions, it was Full House, Saturday night, and there was a standing ovation, and that's, you know, he was very funny, wasn't he? But he was also, as we know, you know, a very poignant, tender, observant writer that everyone could engage with. He spoke to the audience in a way that few British poets do. That's one of the great things about Aldborough, getting, as we did last night, American poets across to bring a different oxygen into the poetry scene. I'm going to read, first of all, a poem called On the CD I Buy for My Brother, which is, I think, why Paul thought I might... We got talking about why we loved Tony Hoagland, and because it was at a workshop and you had to choose something you would buy for somebody. This is the poem that was the trigger for that. But everyone loves the poem. I shouldn't, should I? Talk about it. I'll just read the thing. I did want to mention about the business about when at this stage of our lives, what we are and what we aren't is so very apparent. That kind of philosophy that comes into a poem, which seems that it might just be hijinks or going having only two dimensions, and it's really got those three. On the CD I buy for my brother, a forlorn guy with a guitar issues bulletins from the coast of melancholia, plaintive dirges in which the macho and romantic run together like two rivers joined into a watershed area that could be called the Big Mississippi Pity Party. And the singer is a loner with a boner, and he's a gomer and a moaner and a long-time roamer, and the moon in his rear view reminds him of a redhead in Natchez with a little anorexia problem who danced the hookie coochie clad in just a green bandana. He says, love don't last, but I recall her head on the pillow surely was a pretty sight. He says, daylight's just a torn open letter saying, Larry, I'm sorry. It's written like that, you know. I mean, this guy is always rowing upstream on the Bad Luck River with a rusty hubcap for a paddle, or looking downward from the precipice of I'm No Good, at the base of which an ocean of whiskey and beer has been performing erosion for years. So it's possible that I am doing my brother no favour by appealing to certain tendencies already in his disposition. But then why should I try to improve him on his birthday when at this stage of our lives, what we are and what we aren't is so very apparent, and the grown-ups we once needed to please are endlessly silent. And the nights are long and hollow like the inside of a tunnel, and the train rushing through that tunnel is moving faster and faster, and you know the cargo in those boxcars is some serious business, while the singer goes on bringing the news that all the clichés are true. And the sunsets are breaking their old records for beauty. I'm now going to read a poem called Lawrence, not as I keep thinking D.H. Lawrence. I grew up next door to D.H. Lawrence a little bit after his time. And so I know I was of the generation which kind of revered and then went against Lawrence, decided that they'd had enough of being of priests and so on. But what I liked, it's a fabulous poem. In fact, when I told Michael Askey that I was going to read this, he said, because Albrecht had the Poetry Trust, had Tony Hoagland, Michael Rosen, and another poet who escapes me, to do a tour, not just round here, but up to Birmingham, and even as far as the mystical lands of Manchester. And in one evening after an event, or just before, I think, Michael said that he actually read this poem to Tony Hoagland before he realised that was a bit presumptuous. But Tony apparently just accepted it, went with it. I wanted to say about this poem, Lawrence, that it's a lovely poem. It's really important that it gets itself right in language. It's not pompous in any way, but it's clear. Tony Hoagland, it was important to him. It's the most important thing, you would think, to get poems right, to let them be themselves, but, to craft them in a way you didn't know they're crafted. That's fantastic. But the great thing about him is that I feel that with that, he also felt that there are more important things than literature. And my bon mot for the day is that D.H. Lawrence also thought there were more important things than literature, and it was D.H. Lawrence. Anyway, Lawrence, this just goes over the page, but they're quite short lines. On two occasions in the past 12 months, I have failed when someone at a party spoke of him with a dismissive scorn. I have failed to stand up for D.H. Lawrence, a man who burned like an acetylene torch from one end to the other of his life. These individuals, whose relationship to literature is approximately that of a tree shredder to stands of old growth forest, these people leaned back in their chairs, bellies full of dry white wine and the odour of some foreign fish, and casually dropped his name the way that pygmies, with their little poisoned spears, strut around the carcass of a fallen elephant. Oh, elephant, they say, you are not so big and brave today. It's a bad day when people speak of their superiors with a contempt they haven't earned, and it's a sorry thing when certain other people don't defend the great dead ones who have opened up the world before them. And though, in the catalogue of my betrayals, this is a fairly minor entry, I resolve, if the occasion should recur, to uncheck my tongue and say, I love the spectacle of maggots condescending to a corpse. Or, you should be so lucky in your brainy, bloodless life as to deserve to lift just one of D.H. Lawrence's urine samples to your arid, psychobiographic, theory-tainted lips. Or maybe I'll just take the shortcut between the spirit and the flesh and punch someone in the face. Because being human beings haven't come that far in their effort to subdue the body, and we still walk around like zombies in our dying, burning world, able to do little more than fight and fuck and crow. Something Lawrence wrote about in such a manner as to make us seem magnificent.
So Tony was my really dear friend, and he was the shit kicker of all time. That's what I think about Tony. And it wasn't always standing ovations. Wasn't always standing ovations with Tony. We did gigs all over the place, one of which I remember him almost a sort of stage invasion, but not of the good kind, as people were trying to pull him off the stage. We fled with a woman just shouting at us, I was raped by a man called Tony. And that was it. And we had to get into a car and rehabilitate with a hamburger. So you never knew what was going to come with Tony. He wasn't, it wasn't always a slam dunk. He never phoned it in. It was always a kind of precarious walk with him when you were in the live environment or the personal environment. I first met Tony through another very senior American poet, Robert Bly. And I had been invited to come over to America to meet Robert. And at that time, I'd never been to the States. So I had the most peculiar, warped experience of America, because within about an hour of arriving, I'd met James Hillman, Coleman Barks, Jane Hirschfield, Galway Connell, Robert Bly, and sort of, you know, an exfoliating amount of poets. And I thought, they've all got it wrong. America's fantastic. And over the years, it's changed a little bit for me. But Tony was the really abiding friendship that came from all of it. I don't know about you, but as I get older, friendships, they're harder to find somehow. They don't come along so often. And I don't know why he loved me as much as he did, but he did. And I loved him. And we were an odd team going out with my wild Gaelic stories and his incredibly sort of contemporary, witty, but very deep American poems. But that was how it was. We were Tweedledum and Tweedledee for the best part of a decade. And I miss him terribly. There's not a day that I don't think about him. It's a proper grief that I feel. And I'm actually very happy to have this moment just to say how much I loved him and how much I owe him. I'm really enjoying these poems, so I have to read one before I forget it. OK. God, they're all so good. But this is from his book, Application for Release from the Dream, and it's called But the Men. You are probably aware of something called the men's movement that flourished about 20 years ago, and this sort of comes a little bit from that. But the men, they want back in. All the Dougs, the Michaels, the Darnells, the Erics, the Jose's, they're standing by the off-ramp of the interstate. They are holding up cardboard signs which say, "We'll work for relationship." Their love mobiles are dented and rusty. Their shagging wagons are up on cinder blocks. They're reading self-help books and practicing abstinence. They're taking out personal ads that say, "Good listener, would like to meet lesbian ladies for purposes of friendship only." In short, they've changed their mind. The men, they want another shot at the collaborative enterprise. They want to do 50-50 housework and childcare. They want commitment renewal weekends and couples therapy. Because being a man was finally just too sad. In spite of the perks, the lifetime membership benefits, it got old telling the joke about the hooker and the priest at the company barbecue, remarking on the beer and punching the shoulder of a bud in a little overflow of homosocial bonhomie. Now they're ready to talk. I mean, they are really ready to talk about their feelings. In fact, they are ready to make you sick with revelations of their vulnerability. A pool of testosterone is spreading from around their feet. It is draining out of them like radiator fluid, like history, like an experiment that failed. So here they come, on their hands and their knees, the men. Here they come. They're really beaten. No tricks this time. No fine print. Please, they are begging you. Look out. So I have a love for that. But here's something that you may not have come across yet. So Tony and I were always getting into all sorts of scrapes, and we ended up in Wales in about 2013, summer of 2013, wandering around the hills for a week. And Tony had noticed that at the time I was writing in a kind of prosy form, long Orkney folk tales. And we were on a car drive, and he said, "Have you ever thought about putting them into stanzas? Because there's a sort of swing to them and a kind of poesis that you could really tune up if you just choreographed them on the page in a different way." I hadn't thought about this, but I said, "You know, would you be willing?" And he said, "Absolutely, I would." And Tony, he didn't change much, but he just worked like a tap dancer on taking these big blocks of words and giving them all sorts of oxygen. He sort of oxygenated the stories. And then over a time, we started to work on lyric poems. There's a very famous book a lot of you will probably know, A Celtic Miscellany by Kenneth Hurlston Jackson. We work with that a lot. And a lot of anonymous little lyric poems, Irish and Welsh particularly, we started to do what we would not really call legitimately translations. We'd have to call them versions because we were up to sort of various mischiefs that bring academics out in an understandable cold sweat. So this is one of them, and I'll finish with this. This is by someone you probably know, Dafydd Ap Gwilym. It's called The Stars. "I have a reckless love. It bids instruction to my feet, sends me long miles, makes me crawl through the swamp and the copse and the bracken to meet my generous woman. Our hair tangles on the pillow, and her body is a warm stable. In Maytime, we rut right there under the beech trees, alive in the greenness of things, the nightjars flickering, the heavy horses alive in the orchard. kings of the apple reign. Yes, it is a boastful love. But last night was different. A crisper evening makes a many-miled walk to my lover's hall. And I was night blind. My eyes were pulp on the pitch-black road, ghoul-thin across the moor. I was calling on Tristan, that southern hawk, who always found his chalk-white woman. But I careened like a gypsy, and I lost my way. So much for the old stories. I staggered about in mud-ridged fields. 9 thickets caught my finger and my jacket. I gripped an ancient wall like a sailor grips his oar when he sees the storm is coming. Ahead was the brow of some terrible mountain, thick with goblin, amok with caves, a dungeon of my own making. So I called up to the heavens. Holy Maker, I ask for bail. In the speech of my people, I barter tonight. If brought safe to my lover's hall, I will go on pilgrimage. I am Apgwilym, bring me bright path, and I will lower my head to the babe that was born in the glow of animals. The stars came out then, brilliant and holy, a gold foam to one without shelter. It was a wild zodiac. It laced the black roof of my becoming, this rushlight of the 12 signs. It was a torch blaze of naming. These are different names, old Celtic names for the stars. Heaven's bonfires, cherry-sparked foxfire, glands of the moon, full fruit of the bronze-white foam, night's candles, hoarfrost scattering, bone-ground circles, hammered shield rivets of the sun, pebbles of the blue stream, longing's half-pennies, saddle-stones of the black riders. They are so high the wind cannot wash them. They are embers from the old god's blaze. 100 altars to the whinnying lovers, a mock in the smoky dark. And it was these stars, this pure light, that showed me the way on the muddied track, the sluice-wet valley, the bruising rocks, and I scampered on reprieve, wet, hot-backed, strange blessed by a mossy Christ. I came to the day-breaking door of my true love's hall. My friends, I make no great display of my suffering, no tinker's parade of my woe, but I say this to my girl of the deep valley. My keen-edged axe shall not strike twice against the side of this rock. So that is the kind of place that Tony and I lived in a lot of the time. And I'll go and sit down now, but the last thing I want to say is he was a generous man. He was erratic, he was brilliant. Like all of us, he was a little more recognition is never a bad thing, you know. But at the same time, whenever Tony actually got some recognition, whenever the stage was set for Tony, he'd often walk on and spend the first 20 minutes reading other people's poems. That's a class act. And that was something about Tony. Thank you.
Thank you for being here. Tony liked having readers in England. Well, he liked having readers. It was really entertaining to hear his poems read in English accents, actually. I've never had the privilege of hearing Lawrence read by someone else. Poetry was Tony's culture and religion, his occupation and preoccupation. It was the filter through which he viewed human life, himself, and the world. And he was very grateful for all that poetry gave him, a life of the mind and of the imagination,
and what he considered his great good luck teaching. I'm really relieved not to have to speak too much about Tony publicly because there are so many of his own words to use instead. And as both Josh and Martin mentioned, he was an incredibly active, generous reader of poetry with the broadest palette of anyone I know. And he often read the work of others, other poets at his readings. So with that in mind, I'm going to read a poet by Robert Bly, who's always been mentioned, one of both a person and a poet that Tony really loved. And then I'm going to read two poems by Tony. So this Robert Bly poem is called "The Resemblance Between Your Life and a Dog." I never intended to have this life, believe me. It just happened. You know how dogs turn up at a farm and they wag but can't explain? It's good if you can accept your life. You'll notice your face has become deranged, trying to adjust to it. Your face thought your life would look like your bedroom mirror when you were 10. That was a clear river touched by mountain wind. Even your parents can't believe how much you've changed. Sparrows in winter, if you've ever held one, all feathers, burst out of your hand with a fiery glee. You see them later in hedges. Teachers praise you, but you can't quite get back to the winter sparrow. Your life is a dog. He's been hungry for miles, doesn't particularly like you, but gives up and comes in. Well, the other thing that I was remembering when Josh was talking was that for a number of years we had a home base on Cape Cod, and I was cleaning out our shed, and I found these mimeographed poems. Remember mimeographs? From when Tony was a graduate student. Actually, no, from when he was an undergrad. And we were just amazed. They were so terrible. But they also had all of his skills and talent in them. So you could see what he had to work with. But we laughed a lot. They were pretty bad. They didn't stay bad, though. Okay, so this poem is called Nobility. It's not a narrative, but it contains a narrative. I would say that all of the references in it cannot be used for historical reference. Nobility. In the 3,000 letters written by Virginia Woolf between 1930 and 1941, she does not once express anxiety about the size of her rear end. To have aesthetics, says Robert, is to be a snob, to be above certain things, even parts of yourself. Aldous Huxley, on his deathbed, unable to speak, writes on a white pad to Evelyn, his wife, the note, 100 micrograms mescaline, I am. She nods and brings it back in an hour. I tell this story several times to Kath until I am sure she gets my point. Walking in Jackson Park, I find a great 200-year-old oak extending its huge dark limbs in all directions, like an antler or a chandelier. I stand and stare at it as at a letter in an alphabet I have forgotten. But I am a creature who still has not learned to read, not even to worship, not even to live without dishonesty. The nurse's aide says, "Did we have a bowel movement today, Mr. Mandela?" And he looks at her with so much tolerance and calm. It is like the sea looking back at the land. In the cancer clinic waiting room, the patients are mostly quiet. Sometimes they talk about the football game or the weather predicted for tomorrow. And I'll finish with this poem called Voyage. I feel as if we opened a book about great ocean voyages and found ourselves on a great ocean voyage, sailing through December around the Horn of Christmas and into the January sea, and sailing on and on in a novel without a moral, but one in which all the characters who died in the middle chapters make the sunsets near the book's end more beautiful. And someone is spreading a map upon a table, and someone is hanging a lantern from the stern, and someone else says, I'm only sorry that I forgot my blue parka. It's turning cold. Sunset like a burning wagon train, sunrise like a dish of cantaloupe. Clouds like two armies clashing in the sky. Icebergs and tropical storms. That's the kind of thing that happens on our ocean voyage. And in one of the chapters, I was blinded by love. And in another, anger made us sick like swallowed glass. And I lay in my bunk and slept for so long I forgot about the ocean, which all the while was going by right there outside my cabin window. And the sides of the ship were green as money, and the water made a sound like memory when we sailed. Then it was summer, under the constellation of the swan, under the constellation of the horse. At night, we consoled ourselves by discussing the meaning of homesickness. But there was no home to go home to. There was no getting around the ocean. We had to go on finding out the story by pushing into it. The sea was no longer a metaphor. The book was no longer a book. That was the plot. That was our marvelous punishment. Thank you.
Thank you so much for the really beautiful and elucidating contributions from Josh, Peter, Martin, and Kathleen. As Josh was talking and he read an early poem of Tony's and then a later poem, it occurred to me that so many poets kind of lose it after a while or something. And of course, Tony died relatively young, but he was always good. He just was absolutely, the work was always strong. And I would be curious, just because we have a couple of minutes still, for each of you to say which was your favorite collection, if you had one. I suppose implicit in your talk was the first collection, Josh.
I think the book that you first fall in love with the poet reading tends to be the imprint book. And
yeah.
It's almost like a translation. It doesn't matter if a better one comes along, that's the one.
Yeah. And did you read from the Selected, so it was one of the first three books with the D.H. Lawrence poem.
Because I'm right to think, in thinking that it's because of Tony coming over here that Blood Acts took him on, really, that published him over here.
Mm-hmm.
It was a complete revelation.
Mm-hmm.
And what great, you know that it's not called the Selected poems, it's called What Narcissism Means to Me.
I just love them all. This one that I read from, Application for Release from the Dream, is a particular favourite. It's embarrassing how good it is. I mean, of everything that I've heard, which I've enjoyed everything, that moment that you described where, for poets, hearing Tony for the first time is rapture, closely aligns to dismay when you realize that this guy is doing so many things at the same time, so gracefully and so quickly, it can temporarily make you think about retirement. But the work is just so damn good that I come back to it. So I would say this one, and probably because while I was friends with him, this was one of the books he was working on.
And Kathleen, do you have a favorite? Were you his first reader?
Yes.
And second and third and everything. I might end with a poem that it might not be. I could choose so many. I love so many. But I thought this one, Mistaken Identity, kind of deals with that liminal space between the living and the dead. It's from the second collection, Donkey Gospel. That was the second collection, yeah. And that was the one I was given as a gift 20 years ago, and that's my favorite, probably, although I love all of them. Thank you, everybody, for attending. Mistaken Identity. I thought I saw my mother in the lesbian bar with a salt gray crew cut, a nose stud, and a tattoo of a parrot on her arm. She was sitting at a corner table, leaning forward to ignite on someone's match, one of those low tar things she used to smoke. And she looked happy to be alive again after her long marriage to other people's needs. Her 20-year stint as Sisyphus, struggling to push a blue Ford station wagon full of screaming kids up a mountainside of groceries. My friend Deborah had brought me there to educate me on the issue of my own unnecessariness, and I stood against the wall, trying to look simultaneously nonviolent and nonchalant, watching couples slow dance in the female dark, but feeling speechless, really, as the first horse to meet the first horseless carriage on a cobbled street. That's when I noticed Mom whispering into the delicate seashell ear of a brunette running a fingertip along the shoreline of a tank top, as if death had taught her finally not to question what she wanted, and not to hesitate in reaching out and taking it. I want to figure out everything right now before I die, but I admit that in the dark, where a whole life can be mistaken, cavern of that bar, it took me one, maybe two big minutes to find my footing and to aim my antiquated glance over the shoulder of that woman, pretending not to be my mother, as if I were looking for someone else.